On this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, I sit down with Kevin Bupp to uncover financial freedom through mobile home parks.
Hey Mavericks, this is Ava Baukamp, and this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks is brought to you by Legacy Impact Investors. We are an industrial investment firm located in cash flow country, the Midwest. We strive to shield off risk and beat inflation, all while producing predictable cash flow. We curate real estate investment opportunities for busy professionals and other real estate investors seeking passive income. To learn more about what we do and connect with me, go to www.legacyimpactinvestors.com.
Maverick, noun, unusual person, a visionary, leader, go-getter, an independent thinker. They see the vision for their life and pull that future towards them with an unyielding belief that things can and must be better. They achieve what most won't. Innovative, influential, daring, and direct, with a remarkably high tolerance for taking calculated risk. A foe to the status quo. This is Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks. Your host, Neil Timmons, has been involved with over $300 million in real estate transactions. He's a published author, commercial property investor, and real estate syndicator. This show is for those who want to learn how to earn passive income through real estate investing. Now, here's your host, Neil Timmons.
Welcome to Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, where we provide you actionable steps to grow your passive income and become job optional. Today, you're going to get to discover financial freedom through mobile home parks. Now, for those of you who are new, I'm your host, Neil Timmons. I love passive income from real estate. Before I introduce you to today's Maverick, I want to make a request that at any point, like what you hear, well, give us a thumbs up. Be certain to subscribe to the show. Never miss a valuable episode. And if you love what you hear, give us a written review. Plus, be sure to look at the description of this episode. We packed it with thousands of dollars in free resources. Now, today, we've got the privilege to learn from a person who's been involved in hundreds of millions of dollars of mobile home parks, been doing this in the mobile home park space for over 14 years. Now, prior to his career in real estate, well, he's been in real estate pretty much forever. He said he was a bartender at one point, but started his career in real estate in single family homes. Ultimately, 2008 changed it all, and I'll share that story with you. Now, I would describe today's Maverick, someone who's absolutely passionate about creating affordable housing and creating financial freedom for himself and his investors and his firm. Today's Maverick, I've got Kevin Bupp here with me today. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Neil, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
It's a pleasure. Say, hey, for the audience's sake, who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
Yeah, no, sounds good. So Kevin Bupp, you got that first part down. Where am I from? I live in the Tampa Bay, Florida area. Not originally from here. Been here over 20 years now. Basically, most of my entire adult life, but originally from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. It's the capital, but very small city, very small town there in Pennsylvania, down here in Florida, you know, 20 plus years ago. And what do? I invest in real estate. I've been a full-time investor my entire adult life. I always like to joke and say I've never actually had a real job. About the closest I ever got was tending bar while I was going to school. And from that point, dove into real estate back when I was 19, and I have been doing it ever since. So there's been a few side shoot hustles along the way, but real estate has always been my full-time income generator. And today, what that looks like for us is we're a boutique private equity firm that specializes in mobile home parks, as well as parking assets. So parking lots, parking garages. And we've been investing in mobile home parks now for about 14 years, way back before they were cool.
It was cool. So, take me to the beginning. Tell me about the very first commercial asset or whatever category it falls in. Tell me about the very first one you bought.
Yeah, the very first commercial asset, I got my start in residential like a lot of folks, and I actually acquired a couple hundred single family rental properties over a period of about 8 years. And so that was really where I spent the majority of my time. I guess the first phase, right? I like to classify it as the first phase, but getting to commercial real estate, I was introduced to it while I was frantically running around trying to manage this. At that point, it was about 130 single family homes, and I had acquired those in just a short period of time, about 4 years, and was just frantically trying to figure out the efficiencies behind the property management model, right? We had property management vertically integrated, and someone brought me a 24 unit multifamily property. And right then and there, I didn't even really think of it. The numbers look good, right? That's all I looked at first and foremost. The numbers look good. The economics look good. But what I realized within probably 6 months of owning is that the efficiencies of running that were far greater than running that single family home portfolio. So that was my very first commercial property. And then I've owned office, I've owned retail, I've owned self-storage, medical office, you name it. There's really not too many things that I haven't at least owned a piece of or owned a number of, but ultimately landed on mobile home parks about 14 years ago and have loved it ever since.
How'd you stumble into mobile home parks?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a fairly significant portfolio of single family and multifamily going into 2008. I was down here in Florida, and Florida was a very different landscape, economy then than what it is today. It's much more diverse in nature today and much more stable. I wasn't solely relying upon construction, which is a big portion of the job base back then. And lost a lot of, we can dive into it if you want, but I'll leave it at, struggled quite a bit in 2008, had a lot of financial challenges trying to maintain the portfolio and ultimately lost a lot of what I had built. Leading up to 2008, lost that in a period of roughly a year and a half, 2 years during the financial crisis. And I played damage control about 3 years, 2008 to 2010 and a half. It was really damage control, just trying to keep my head above water, trying to figure out not necessarily what the next step was, but literally who was coming up behind me. And when I finally got my wits and not my head out of the sand per se, but just really when I finally had that moment of clarity of like, okay, let's start thinking about like tomorrow. Let's start thinking about like what's next, because what's happened happened. And so I kind of went on an exploratory journey, and that was just trying to figure out what the landscape looked like today than what it had 3 years prior. Like, you know, for those that made it through or those that were investing at that point in time. And I kind of had set my sights on multifamily. I was like, you know what? I'm not going to even rebuilding, way more efficient, just focusing on multifamily. That was the way I was going to go. And so I just went and met everyone I could. And during that little journey there, I was introduced to by a guy by the name of Randy. He was a commercial banker, had been for 30 years of his adult life, and retired. A friend of mine's like, you should go meet Randy. He's just a cool guy. But that's it. He's like, he's a cool guy. He retired as a commercial banker, and he might be able to introduce you to somebody else. And I met Randy, didn't know too much about him, just wanted to have lunch with him. And he happened to own a number of mobile home and RV parks here in Florida. He basically had a number of clients for 10 years of his banking career and was on the other side of the P&L of a number of clients that owned mobile home parks and RV parks, and realized that maybe he had been on the wrong side of the table for many years. And then when he retired, he's like, that's my retirement. I'm buying a couple of those. And so he owned three when I met him. They're fairly large ones, but owned three mobile home parks. And during that 2-hour luncheon that we had, just he was learning about me, I was learning about him. And pretty much the entire time, every time multifamily came, he didn't bash multifamily, but he just tried to tell me in his own words why he felt mobile home parks might be something I should look at and consider, as they offer some, you know, some benefits that multifamily might not. And so he piqued my interest enough during those 2 hours ago that I left there, and I had not bought anything from late 2007 to that point. So it was kind of okay, this is the first step. I spent about a year exploring as much as I could about that asset class. And ultimately in late 2011, I bought my first mobile home park up in Atlanta, Georgia. And that was the first of many. So that was it. That luncheon and that conversation with Randy, that was it. That piqued my interest enough where I said, I'm going to go buy this and either prove or disprove how great these things are. And Here we are today.
What was the size of that one? The very first one?
It was small. It was a 34 space.
Okay.
34 spaces. It was an REO property. It had been vacant for 2 years. All 34 units were owned by the park. All of them were vacant, vandalized. All the AC units had been stolen. The steps were removed by the special servicer that was overseeing the property. It was a disaster, but we bought it really cheap and it was in a good area. And that was it. That was the first taste of it. And then just, I fell in love, not right away. It took me a while to actually start getting some money coming in and realizing that this model worked. And fast forward, now we bought and sold over 50 mobile home parks throughout the US and are doing it today.
Bring me current. Tell me about the most recent deal.
Yeah, the most recent deal, we just closed by the skin of our teeth, December 29th, basically the last business day of the year, of the calendar year. Closed actually what happened to be our largest single mobile home park transaction, both by number of spaces and by dollar amount that we've ever closed in our career. And so that was a 738 space mobile home community in Fort Wayne, Indiana, institutional quality property. And just the timing was right. A lot of institutional players that typically would have been a buyer for that. Have been on the sidelines, and we've been very conservative the last couple of years. And so we've had a lot of capital just waiting and just ready to pounce on opportunity, and it presented itself and we got that one to the closing table. So very proud of that one.
Yeah, you should be. Good for you. Going from 30 some odd pads, totally vacant, all sorts of problems, to institutional quality, tons of lessons in between that time frame. What are the top 3, 4, 5 things, whatever it may be, that you learned along the way about mobile home parks and then maybe about yourself too?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's obviously a lot of lessons along the way about mobile home parks. So I'll start with some of the basics. You know, the very first one, like I said, we basically owned all the mobile homes. So we had all the titles. It was a horizontal apartment complex. And so with that being said, all the maintenance and repair associated with those mobile homes was our responsibility. So anytime a roof leaked or plumbing broke or AC went out, like that was our responsibility. And so it adds up pretty quickly. And it creates a very, even on a 34 unit mobile home park, creates a very management intensive business model. Whereas on the flip side of that, which is in a perfect world, Neil, is what I like to say, but we don't live in a perfect world. But in a perfect world, we wouldn't own any of the homes. We would just own the dirt. We'd own the infrastructure and we'd rent the lots back to the homeowners that would then, in fact, own their own homes, fix their own roofs, fix their own plumbing, fix their own HVAC. And so, again, fast forward to today, we do own probably 500 or so individual mobile homes throughout the entire portfolio. We do have a number of communities where we own zero and some that we own, you know, as many as maybe 50 or 60. But the best part of the business model, if you could get into it, is not owning any of the actual personal property or the mobile homes themselves. It really makes it a fairly, it's not passive by any means, but it just makes it a much less management intensive business model. You can run it with a fairly lean staff. There's not a lot of things that happen on a day-to-day basis. So that was a big lesson. And so we tend to stay away from communities that have a large contingent of park-owned mobile homes. However, like I said, we do own hundreds of them in the portfolio today. So maybe a few other things that we've learned along the way is that there's lots of seemingly good opportunities that might present themselves. Like, you know, back then I found myself in the trap of searching for properties based on going in cap rates, right? And I would literally say, okay, well, this is a 12 cap, so this must be better than that 8 cap, right? And I wouldn't really pay as much attention to the actual market that it was in than I would, okay, well, this thing's going to make more money. No matter what, it's going to make more money because I'm buying it at 12 cap, right? And what I've learned, you know, I learned this a long, long time ago, but is that you can fix a broken asset. You can change if it's in a good area, good school districts, and you know there's a good demand for whatever type of housing you're providing in that local marketplace. You can fix the asset. You can fix the infrastructure. You can make it prettier. You can put landscaping in. You can put lighting, sign. I mean, you can make the asset pretty, but you can't fix the market that it's in. And so if you buy a pretty asset or one that seemingly has a great cash flow, you're buying at this phenomenal cap rate, but it's in a really crappy market that's got a declining population base, jobs are going away, going overseas, people are moving out of the area, you can't fix that. There's no way. Like, it's literally a just circular path down the drain. And that's one of the big lessons as well. And probably one of the last big ones, it's very representative of this last deal that we just closed, is just scale. Buying at scale, there's a lot of inefficiencies. It kind of goes back to the single family housing days of us, me having a large portfolio of single family properties. There's a lot of inefficiencies with that. And there's plenty of folks, there's lots of institutions that do it really well. Lots of technology has helped them gain efficiencies that didn't exist 15, 16 years ago. But the same is true with mobile home parks. Managing 10, 34 space communities is much more difficult and management intensive than managing one 340 space mobile home park. And on top of that, there's a much higher perceived value to an end buyer on a larger asset than that of a portfolio of smaller assets. It's going to demand a higher price point, a lower cap rate, and you're going to have better buyers waiting to purchase from you. It's going to be a very different profile of individual that's going to buy that 340 space mobile home community from us than the individual that's going to buy the portfolio of 10 34 space mobile home communities from us. And so there's many more lessons, but those are some of the big ones that I've learned along the way.
What about financing? It seems to me from the outside looking in and certainly touching the asset class on occasion that financing is not the same as office, single family home, certainly, and industrial, whatever it may be, other asset classes. It's a little more nuanced. It's a little more challenged and fewer players in that environment.
I would say that was probably a true statement. I'd probably say it was very a true statement 6 or more years ago or 5 or more years ago. When we started buying parks, it was nearly impossible. I remember literally going and calling 15 community banks in the local area, and maybe one or two even understood the asset class. Maybe one had lent on the asset class, right? And it was always a crapshoot. In fact, there was pros and cons with that. And one of the benefits of banks not fully understanding the asset class way back when was that a lot of sellers also understood that. And so it kind of forced them to have to carry financing, which was a big benefit. But fast forward to today, it's not a secret anymore. It's a very well-known asset class. It's known on an institutional scale. There's lots of data now that supports the asset class. And so the financing today it's very akin to that of multifamily. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. So this loan that we just got on this big property, it was a Freddie Mac loan. We've got many different Fannie Mae agency loans, and their terms are very similar to what you might find on a traditional multifamily property. Once you get below loan amounts of, call it $2 million, I don't know if it exists anymore, but Fannie Mae used to have a small loan balance program where maybe they'd go down to $1 million. I think it went away at some point. It might have come back. I don't know. But lower than that, you're dealing with your typical credit unions, regional banks, local banks. And there's plenty of regional banks now that actually understand the asset class. There's a number that really put an emphasis on making that one of their core focus areas of lending. And so, again, it's nice now that there's a lot of options, but also it gave a lot of those same options to the competition, right? So it's just pros and cons of it, but the financing is very, very available.
Let's stay at a deal level. I'm a passive investor. I'm looking at a variety of, talk to a number of sponsors. I'm looking at deals. What should I pay attention to inside of a particular deal to go maybe red light, green light, or maybe just red flag, something to go hard pass, or at least ask some additional questions to the sponsor about the particular opportunity?
Yeah. I mean, so taking the sponsor out of the equation, we're just talking deal level, correct? I mean, again, back to the whole market itself, right? Like, you don't have to be an expert. You can get on, we use bestplaces.net. There's many other sites just like that where you can literally type in a zip code or the city that it's in and get all kinds of stats, you know, housing stats, population stats, crime stats, things of that nature, what the average rents are for one studio, one, two, three bedroom apartments and homes. And so I would just understand the market first. Like, first and foremost, again, you can't fix the marketplace. And it's not just the market, because you got to get more on a lower micro level when you look at the market itself. Because if you look at just like, use Fort Wayne as an example, Fort Wayne, Indiana, it's a great market, generally speaking. If you look at just the general statistics, it's great. Population growth, job growth. I mean, it's a very diverse economy. But there's also bad neighborhoods in Fort Wayne, right? There's definitely zip codes or areas that where the concentration of the crime exists. And that's pretty common in most cities throughout the U.S. So just getting a much more granular level of where this community is located within that marketplace, and make sure that you're in good school. Even folks that are looking for affordable housing, they want their kids to go to good schools, right? So make sure that you're in a good school district and you're on the right side of town. Look at street views on Google Earth, right? Just generally speaking, get a comfortability with the market and the location within that marketplace that the asset's located. Outside of that, it gets a little tougher from if you're not an active investor, if you have never been an active investor yourself, right? So it gets a little more difficult to be able to pick out little nuances with the deal and with the underwriting. But just ask questions of, just generally speak, what is the business plan, right? What does it look like as far as rent increases? When are they going to happen? What type of capital improvements? And not just very generically, well, we're going to put appliance package and we're going to put cabinet in these units. Like, get pricing so that you can understand, like, does part of their budget of that $10,000 unit, more speaking to maybe a multifamily property, right? Like, does that $10,000 a unit budget for CapEx, and they say they're going to do appliances, cabinets, flooring, paint, and bathrooms. Like, I know immediately, at least I do personally, that you're not going to get all that done for $10,000. So give me a breakdown line by line. Like, what are you budgeting for these cabinets that you're going to put in? And just, again, you can do some quick shopping, go to Home Depot, go to Lazada. You can look very quickly and get a general idea of, like, these guys are crazy. Where, I don't know how they came up with these numbers, right? And so lots of little things like that you can probably get an understanding of and start picking apart a business model. But aside from the sponsor, those are some of the things that I would look at and that I would suggest that you get a good comfortability on. But again, even if the sponsor's not great, even if their plan kind of fails, if you're in the best location, it really does always win out. It's not necessarily going to always save a deal, even if, like, you got a poor operator, but I'd sure as hell rather have an A-class premier location in the event that does go south or go sideways, that there's going to be 10 other people waiting in line to buy that thing and hopefully get my money back to me. So anyway, there's probably a million other things we could talk about there, but those are the first couple that come to mind.
Are you a passive real estate investor seeking financial freedom? Well, today's market's unique and it's ever-changing. Now is the time to get educated on how to strategically invest in commercial real estate for long-term financial freedom. Grab your copy of How to Passively Invest in a Changing Economic Environment. Go to www.mavericksinvest.com. I'm going to go down one path. I want to go one question, and then I'll pivot here off the deal level. But at the deal level, mobile homes, for all intents and purposes, they're not really mobile, right? They are, but they aren't. They are. There's a relatively heavy cost associated with it. As a result of that, it's a very attractive asset class to be able to go in, to be able to move rents in an upward fashion pretty quick-like. Is there a threshold, or maybe what's the threshold if an operator is going, we think we can move rents here? The next question, of course, is over what kind of time frame? There's a lot of legislation across the country who would like to see somebody have significant levels of restriction about the ability to move rents and certainly the speed to move those rents. But what seems like fairly realistic to move over a period of time, what's a little heavy that you might be asking that operator some additional questions?
There's really, I wish I had exact science to it, and there just really isn't, Neil. There's some folks within the industry that might say, well, we like to set the market. We look at whatever studio rents might be for apartments. Say, if you go to apartments.com, whatever site you're going to get your data from. And We feel that lot rents could, the market for lot rents within this respective market should be in line with maybe where, or 80% of where studio apartment rents are. I mean, it's so generic in nature, it's really hard to use that as a gauge, but it might be one of the gauges. Most of the time, what we do is there's been very few times where we've gone into a market where there hasn't been at least another larger professional operator in there already. There might be a lot of mom and pop still, and very quickly you'll get to identify who that professional operator is and who the mom and pops are just based on the delta between where the rents are. And that professional probably has already started to push the rents over time. They probably have also done improvements to justify the rent increases. But if that already exists, then we typically like to use that as the barometer. And if we're going to go in and buy one of those mom and pop communities, we're going to use that as the barometer to kind of chase down. There has been a few times where we've had to set the market. We've been the first ones there that have gone to consolidate a mom and pop marketplace. And it's a little bit of guesswork. It's a little bit of, hey, like, I want to be morally and ethically fair to these residents. And they haven't had rent increases for a long time. Yes, that's true. But also, they haven't had rent increases in a long time. So let's make this a little bit more palatable for them. Let's make this something that doesn't completely throw their personal finances out of whack. At the end of the day, it's still affordable housing. And a lot of these folks have built their budget, their personal budgets around food and vehicle and, you know, supplies for their kids' education and clothing, things that around what they're currently paying, what they've been paying for years past. So we'll go in, and I'd say the most that we've ever, I'm not gonna say the most that we've ever pushed it, but like how we typically, the threshold we like to stay in is like no more than like 10%. And that's kind of an extreme. That's like if the rents hadn't been raised in a long time, there's a big delta there. You know, maybe we'll go in and do a 10% increase, but typically it's somewhere between like 5 and 8%. And then years thereafter, we'll keep it in like the 5 to 6% range in order to catch market. And if we're already at market, we'll normally do it somewhere in like the 3 to 4% range, just keep up with, you know, basic inflation. So there's no science to it. Every market's a little different than the next. I wish I had a better answer than that, because it's literally, we've got communities in 16 states now. We've been in a few very liberal states over the years. We've been in a number of very red states over the years. And I would say that we've had equal amounts of challenges in red states as we've had in blue states, and vice versa. And probably the biggest challenge we've ever had, though, has been in New York. We've owned in New York. We no longer are there. We actually owned communities there when rent control got put in place. I think it was 2019, statewide rent control. Statewide rent control, probably it is the strictest at this point in time in the entire country, and ultimately decided to exit out of those assets and move on. It's just very difficult to do business there. But to give you a case in point of one of those deals, when we owned it, when we bought it, this is a good case study to use. When we bought this asset, 100% occupied, owned by the original developer, they'd owned it for 40 years. Four-star community. If it had an amenity like a pool or something along those lines, it'd have been a five-star. Most of these homes had two-car garages. They look like single-family homes because some of them were double and triple wides, and they were parallel to the road, so they're really wide and had connected breezeways. I mean, it looked like a neighborhood. And the market in this area when we bought this asset back in 2017 was between 525 and 550. When we bought this asset, the rents were 260. Yeah, the owner just, he would go 5-6 years, and if he raised it, it might be $5, right? It wasn't going to be manageable, even with just the tax reassessment, it wasn't going to be manageable to maintain those rents and keep the $5 rent increases in place every couple of years. And so we actually put forth a 5-year plan, worked with the residents to give them an understanding what these 5 years are going to look like to hopefully get closer to market. And your notice that we were going to raise the rents $60. Okay. So that's a, proportionally speaking to what they're paying, that's a decent bump. But based on the market, we felt was very fair in nature. And you would have thought the world ended, Neil. I mean, with the community went on rent strike, they got local legislators involved. I mean, it was a regulatory nightmare. We've never experienced anything like that in any other community, but doing a $60 rent increase or $50 rent increase, but there it happened. And so I wouldn't have guessed that would have happened just based on the quality of the residents. It wasn't, these homes were $150,000 homes. So it wasn't a, I can't afford my rent now. Most of them had really nice cars in the driveways, boats in the driveways. It wasn't even really affordable housing, but everyone was up in arms and the state got involved and it was a complete nightmare. So I wish I had a better answer for you, but there's not an exact science to it. You do your best to understand the market, not just like what other people are doing in the market, but understand the market and the actual residents themselves who are there and somewhat take your best stab at it. I wish I had a better answer, yeah, but there you go.
That's great. The color you provided is meaningful too. That's helpful. Let's go to the sponsor level. When you think about the investors you have, you may be the top folks. What type of questions are they asked, team? So of course, I'm thinking for an investor coming along the way, educating themselves, listening to this. What types of things should they be cognizant of at the sponsor level? What should they be asking of you, the sponsors who do this type of product? What do they want to understand?
That's a great question. I'd say probably the most common theme that goes round and round almost every time, and if they don't know it already, right? It's like over the years, my podcast, I give a lot of history of what I've done historically, things of that nature. But if they don't know a lot about us and they haven't heard it maybe another time, the very common theme is like your background. Like, what have you done, right? Like, you know, deals that you've done, both as your current company, both of deals that you've done prior to actually building this company, like yourself, how much personal money do you have invested in this endeavor? What's your current financials look like? Like, are you a solid financial state today in the event something goes sideways, you know, in this company or with a deal? And I'd say that pretty much is asked almost every single time. The track record, and then also what's your current financial position? How much money do you have into these deals? And then what's your balance sheet look like, right? Like, what kind of financial health are you and the company currently in? And that's even more important now than maybe even 3 years ago. It's always important, but I feel like a lot of folks had not asked that question leading into some of the challenges some syndicators are facing at present time with some deals going sideways. So outside of that, just really understanding the long-term business plan. We typically put investors in three different buckets. You've kind of got first bucket, which is they're willing to take a little bit higher risk, but they're looking to recycle that capital to get higher returns, right? Higher risk, higher returns, but they're looking to keep the momentum of that money flowing. And so they're normally the guys that want to get in. They went in and out and to get into new deals, right? They want to keep it compounding and rolling. They're still trying to build that wealth. They got some, but it's not enough. They want a lot more. And they got the other end of the spectrum. They've made it. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt, right? They just don't want to lose the money. They got all they need. They just don't want to lose it. They're more in the wealth preservation mode. And then you got the folks in the middle that kind of are a little bit of the two. They've made a lot, not willing to take as many risks, but also aren't willing to, you know, just get single digit returns. And so understanding who your investor is and then aligning that with the actual deal itself, right? Is this a deal that you absolutely, the business plan is get in, get out in 3 years and then do it over again and then do it over again? Or is this a, like for us, we're much more of a long-term hold. We don't like to be forced to sell assets and not making any more mobile home parks. And so if we find an asset in a phenomenal market, it's not a good fit for an investor to come in to think that we're our sole intent is to get the original capital back to them. But also on top of that, there's absolutely no expectation set that we're going to be in and out of this entire fund in 3 to 5 years. In fact, that's complete opposite of what our long-term business plan is. And so making sure that your investment philosophy and personal and investment goals aligns with that of the sponsor. Like, and I feel like that gets missed a lot. It gets learned normally like on the first maybe deal or two, someone they might invest passively. And then either that deal sells in 2 years and then the person's like, that was great, but not. I got this tax, and thanks for giving my money back. Thanks for giving me this huge return, but I also got this tax event that I've got to deal with, and I've got to find another place to put this money. And like, that's a good problem, but it's a problem, right? And so don't know if we want to keep going down that road, but like, those are some of the huge ones. They come up often, and those are things that potential LPs need to be asking of sponsors just to better understand the business plan.
From my experience doing this, you hit it on the head, and you've tackled a big one, is the alignment of plans, interests, right? To know where you're going is where the other person's going. Same thing when you're trying to find a spouse. You want to know you're on the same page, right?
Yeah, right. The thing is, it is a marriage.
Yeah.
It really is.
Committing to several years. Yeah.
These are illiquid deals for the most part. And it's long-term no matter what, because, you know, whether it be 2 years, 3 years, or 12 years, 2 and 3 years is a long time to have your money tied up with an investor or in an investment. So it's illiquid and it's very much a marriage. You need to look at it. So
2024, what are you most excited about this year?
Yeah. So as I had alluded to, we've been very conservative as a company for the heyday years, 2020, 2021, 2022. In fact, we've been more net sellers of assets, really pruning the portfolio, just disposing of assets that great assets, but just take advantage of the peak prices and then pruning out assets that we felt for XYZ reasons, just we wouldn't see as holding for a very long period of time, whether it be the market or their asset itself, you know, many different reasons. And so there was some anxiety over the years. There's always a push-pull with myself and the other principal in our group. He pretty much runs the capital raise side and the investor relations team. And I'm more on the acquisitions and I kind of run the op side of the house. And there's always a push-pull of there's a lot of capital looking for a home years ago, right? And we've always been conservative buyers. And you know, there's always a, hey, Kevin, like I got all this money looking for a home. And I'm like, well, I don't have any deals I feel that make a ton of sense, right? Like I wanted to not just buying deals to buy deals. I'm not just buying assets to brag about how many units we have, right? And so it's been a weird sense of anxiety. We bought some great deals, but just not as much as maybe a lot of other folks over the last couple of years. However, I think the tide's turned for us because last year literally was our best year ever. We bought $83 million of assets. It's been our single biggest year. And I can only attribute that to less competition. And two of the three deals we bought were, I wouldn't say distressed, but you don't sell unless you have to sell. You were not selling assets in 2023 unless you were not forced, but there was one reason or another why it was better to sell than to hold, right? And so I'll leave it at that. And so I'm excited about 2024 because it's really 2023 forced our company to bring on some additional staff, bring on additional talent to really support that growth. And the talent pool has opened up quite a bit too. So a lot of other folks were kind of pulling back the reins. So we've picked up some just phenomenal team members, really excited to have them on board. And so the infrastructure that we put in place now over the past 6 months will allow us to have another year like we had in 2023. And I think the opportunity is going to be there, not necessarily from distress per se, just because a lot of folks are still uncertain about the rate environment or their equity dried up, right? So maybe they were relying upon institutional equity and it's not there right now, right? Like they're kind of like twiddling their thumbs, and we've got a really good retail engine underneath us. We've paid 24 consecutive quarters of on-time distributions and got a great track record. It's really set us up for just success. And I'm excited about that. I'm really excited about that.
That's great. Let's do this. I want to move on to the final segment, what I call the final four. What do you think holds most passive investors back from hitting their next level, whatever that next level happens to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say it goes back to the alignment, just really ensuring that you're finding the right alignment with your investment goals and finding the right sponsor to help you achieve those goals. I think that's the biggest one.
Outside of real estate, what are you passionate about?
My family. I do this so I can spend as much time as possible with my family. We travel a lot together and just trying to get as much out of these years. I've got a 7 to 10 year old and my wife, we've been married for 14 years now, and try to get as much personal time and family time with them as possible.
Your favorite book? Besides your own, over your shoulder.
Yeah. That's a great question. It's hard to pick just one. I guess I'll pick one that I've recently read and I've read a number of times. It's The Go-Giver. And I always forget the damn author, but it's a phenomenal short book just about giving back and the benefits of giving back.
Yeah. Speaking of giving back, what's your favorite way to make an impact in the community?
That's a great question as well. I personally host a charity bike ride event. So one of my other passions is cycling, road cycling. And I started a charity event back in 2010 called 72 Hours of Key West. It's a 3-day, 280-mile bike ride from Fort Myers Beach down to Key West. And all the proceeds from that event go to a couple of local charities here in the Tampa Bay area. They're near and dear to my heart. So most of what my charitable endeavors consist of are that event. My wife and I host the event, 75 cyclists fed and safely down, you know, 280 miles of road from Fort Myers Beach to Key West. Takes about a half a year to actually plan out and pull off. And so that's where a lot of our energy and focus goes.
Tremendous. Kevin, this has been a great conversation. I know we just scratched the surface. We could sit here and talk all day because I know you're a wealth of knowledge. For people, they want to find you, they want to follow you, they want to connect, they want to plug into your podcast. What should they do?
Yes, kevinbupp.com. You can find links to all the different social links on there. My podcast, I host that on there as well. There's information about our company, Sunrise Capital Investors, if you want to go down that path. But definitely just go to my website, kevinbupp.com, and you can find your best path from there.
Links below in the show notes for everybody. Kevin, appreciate the time.
Neil, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
To our listeners, pat yourself on the back. You guys have made it to the end of the show, and most people never finish what they start. If you receive value from today's show, be sure to share it on LinkedIn, your Facebook page, or your social media platform of choice. Subscribe to never miss a valuable episode in the future. And if you found value in today's episode, give us a thumbs up with a positive review. If there's a particular topic you'd like to hear about, well, I want to hear from you. Shoot me a message on LinkedIn. The link to my profile is below in the show notes. You can connect with me there for more valuable content.